Once again, it is good to be in the house of the Lord today to worship, to consider all that our God is. Not only what he's done, but who he is. The one true God and his Son, Jesus Christ, whom he sent into the world. You may be thinking to yourself that we've been slowly removing chairs from this room, but we have not, I assure you. And as you can see, as you look out those doors, we're making every effort to put some more into the room. So, and I was informed just a few minutes ago that the baptistry will arrive today. It's going to be parked out here. And so we may dig a small hole and put some water in it before we even get it in here. Who knows? I'd invite you to return to the book of Jonah with me this morning, and we continue our odyssey through this Old Testament narrative. This prophet of the Lord, who was sent by God to go to the Ninevites, and he refused to do so, as we saw last week. Now, let me remind you again of the outline structure of this little letter, this little book, so that we know where we are along the way. There's an outline here that's based on a parallelism. Okay, and the parallelism is twice over repeated. So you see it in the first half, and then you see it repeated almost exactly the same way in the second half with a follow-up discourse on the end. So it's an A1, B1, C1, and then an A2, B2, C2, and then a D. Okay, so we're in the beginning part of that. So we looked last week at the A1, so that's the first call of Jonah by God. And today we're going to begin into B1, which is Jonah and the sailors. All right, B2 will be Jonah and the Ninevites. But this is B1 at the beginning. This little pericope that we're going to be looking at, starting in verse 4 and going all the way to verse 17, is sandwiched between Jonah's disobedience on the one hand, as he ran from the commission of God, and his grateful prayer that we see starting in chapter 2. So it's sandwiched in between. I had very much considered spending my opening talking about the fact that there are two ways to eat an Oreo cookie, right? One way is just to bite into it, right? The other way is to twist it apart, eat the white stuff in between, and then eat the two cookies, right? Well, we're going to do that this morning. We're going to twist it apart, and we're going to look at that nice white stuff in the middle, all right? But something to consider here. This pericope is important in that it represents what happens when a man is disobedient to the explicit call of God. All right, the B2 of this book will be Jonah being explicitly obedient. All right, so this is Jonah's disobedience. That will be Jonah's obedience. But it's important to remember that this pericope is not the main point of the book. Okay, it's not the main point of the narrative. Yes, it explains how God righted Jonah's disobedience, but it doesn't add or subtract anything from the point of Jonah going to Nineveh to preach, right? It's a tangent, in a sense. It seems rather bizarre to me that the only part of this book that's ever remembered is Jonah in a fish, right? But that's not the primary point of the entire book. It is what we would call in theological circles an indented point between A1 and C1. Okay, so A1's important, C1's important, B1 is kind of in the middle, but it's indented in a sense. It's subtext, it's interesting, it's instructive, but it's not particularly necessary to the overarching point of the book. Sure, it explains God's sovereignty over Jonah, no doubt, but this is subtext to his greater sovereignty over the nations of people, Israel, Assyria, as represented by Samaria and Nineveh, as represented by Jeroboam the first and the king of Nineveh, right? Those are the two really important things. This becomes somewhat of subtext in a book in which the primary message is about the sovereignty of God even over nations through both his compassion and his wrath, which he is free to express as he wills, right? So it's an important passage, no doubt. Ironically, I'm going to have to spend two Sundays on it, but it's not the primary point of the book. All right? It's good text. It's important to understand. There's a lot of valuable lessons in it, but don't get distracted by this passage as the primary point of the book. All right, so we start in verse 4, and this verse says, but the Lord, okay, the but, they're indicating that Jonah had gone to Tarshish to run, or gone down to Joppa to run off to Tarshish, but, all right, but the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea so that the ship threatened to break up. Notice it is the Lord hurled the storm, okay? It's in direct response to Jonah's disobedience. God acts, okay? God specifically acts. This is a moment in time for us to consider one of very important theological point, and that is that we often talk about the providence of God. I'm sorry, the sovereignty of God. Oops, just gave that away. We talk about the sovereignty of God very often, right? And we think about it in, you know, sort of theoretical sense. God is sovereign over everything. Okay, but the providence of God is such that God's sovereignty is worked out in time and space. When we talk about the providence of God, we're talking about his work in time and space to accomplish whatever it is that he has purposed. If he says, I want this to happen, his providence is that he makes that happen. It's the actuating of his decree by involving himself in the affairs of nature and human history through the use of means. It's one of those words you hear Reformed people use quite a bit, means. Okay. Now, I would have you note that a contrary reality often thought of amongst Christians has been something called deism. Whereas God is distant from his creation, where he simply allows it to play out. And I've said many times from this pulpit that the de facto theology embraced by evangelicals in our day is, in fact, a form of deism. In fact, we call it moralistic therapeutic deism. It was coined by Christian Smith in a book back in 2005. Moralistic therapeutic deism is the idea that, well, God's involved, but not really personally and directly, just kind of around, and sometimes he gets involved and most of the time he does not. Most evangelicals have bought into this deistic idea. But the Bible is clear that God works in time and space, and here we have an excellent example of it, where he himself hurls a storm at the ship. He uses a means. He takes something out of time and space, a specific element of the created order through which he acts. Sometimes directly, meaning a primary means, and sometimes indirectly, in something we call a secondary means. Specifically, in the secondary means, the choices and actions of others through which he then acts. So there's providence, which comes under the umbrella of God's sovereignty, and under providence are his means that he uses. Sometimes those means are direct, sometimes those means are indirect. This is an example of a primary means. This is a direct action of God. Now, acts of evil in the world are always secondary means. God does not ever act in any way that is evil. Men do, and God can ordain for those acts of men to become a part of what he has ordained. He may ordain such acts to accomplish his purposes. Judas's betrayal, an act of evil. Judas did it. God ordained it. Pilate's choice to crucify Christ. Pilate's choice, God's ordination. Secondary. A secondary means, because God cannot be accused of doing what is evil. The preaching of the gospel is a means of God bringing his people to faith. God has purposed in his providence to bring his elect out to faith through the ordinary means of the preaching of the gospel by ordinary men. Sometimes even by us who fumble with our words and don't know how to get it out and don't know what to say and feels sometimes like, you know, no, he uses even that to accomplish his purpose of bringing people to faith. Prayer is another example. Prayer is a means used by God to accomplish His will. God has purposed for prayer to be a means through which He acts in time and space. Sometimes we wonder, how come this doesn't happen? Maybe it's simply because God has purposed for us to ask for it first, and then He will act as a result of that, because He has purposed the prayer to be a part of the process through which He works in the world. So what we have in this case then is a great example of a primary means of God accomplishing His will. He sends a great wind upon the sea to afflict the sailors and get Jonah's attention. Now, I didn't put this in the outline, but I wonder if this isn't another example of God speaking something. The storm itself, I would note, is not evil. Okay? The idea of the storm itself is not evil, even though it put the sailors in jeopardy. I agree. But it's not evil. It's a part of the natural order which God used to complete His commission over Jonah. A storm is not evil. It's amoral. God uses it to accomplish something, even though it threatened to break up the ship, which is exactly what it says next. The storm was strong enough to put the sailing vessel and its crew and its cargo in jeopardy. Okay? This wasn't just an ordinary afternoon thunderstorm. All right? There's something bigger going on here. That's the point of what you see. In other words, this is God sending a storm to get Jonah's attention. Maybe. Maybe. Now, verse 5 starts with this. Then the mariners, the sailors, were afraid, and each cried out to his God, and they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and had lay down and was fast asleep. Now, it is undoubtedly true, wouldn't you agree with me, that these mariners were probably experienced sailors who had sailed the Mediterranean. They were quite well aware of storms. They probably had many encounters with them. They knew how to sail a ship on the Mediterranean. So it seems to me that their response indicates the intensity of the storm. The way that they respond gives you the idea that this isn't just an ordinary afternoon thunderstorm with a little light breeze blowing in from the west. This is a hurricane force wind. In fact, they even attempt to mitigate their destruction by lightening the ship. They go to toss the cargo overboard. This is a typical process that you would do. You lighten the ship so it rides higher in the water, and so therefore it's not as likely to be capsized or likely to break deep and take water. A heavier ship sitting down in the water would have a tendency, after coming up over a great wave, to dive then into the next one. And being heavy would actually dive right down into the water itself. That's called breaking deep. So they lighten the ship. They understand what it takes to survive this sort of a thing. But the narrator tells us more than that. They don't just lighten the ship by throwing the cargo overboard. It says they also each cried out to his God. The sailors on this ship were probably of various ethnic backgrounds. Highly likely that this is a wide variety of different kinds of men, each coming out of a different form of paganistic religious practice. Probably no other Israelites, no other Jews on board this boat, except Jonah, more than likely. So they're all going to cry out to their God. So what do you say here? Well, here's what you say. It's obvious, isn't it? As someone once said, there are no atheists in foxholes. There are no atheists in ships about to break up on the sea. Paul starts with that in Romans chapter 1, verse 20. Paul begins his great tome on the nature of the human condition, that all have sinned, by noting that every single human being instinctively knows that there is a creator, and under great pressure will resort to some sort of religious expression. There are no atheists. There is no point in attempting to convince men that there is a God because they already know it. They already know it. So religion, okay, I'll put the adjective pagan on the front of that, but just you can take it off, because religion is simply the expression of the imago Dei, the image of God, out of people suppressing the knowledge of the one true God. I mean, how do we, as those made in the image of a creator, and we know it, what do we do in the midst of the worst calamity possible? We immediately express this reality. It comes out of us. It's just a part of what we are in the imago Dei. That's Paul's point, Romans chapter 1, the early part of verses 18 and beyond. In many cases also, it is people who have no light given by God stumbling around in the dark looking for something to call God. Because they know there's a God, they just don't know who he is. And so the imago Dei in them cries out for God. That's what these sailors are doing. Here they are in the midst of a crisis. Their lives are in danger. And they know it as experienced mariners on the sea. What do we have? But I want to ask a different question. Now I'm going to ask this question. I want you to be very careful about giving me an answer. Okay? Because you're going to have a knee-jerk reaction to my question, but I'm going to suggest that you need to think about your answer a little bit. And the question is this. Is God free to act in such a way over humanity? Is God free to cast storms over the lives of men without their consent? Is he free to withhold knowledge of himself from them? Now, you can see why I told you to be careful here. Because it is our knee-jerk reaction to assert that, yes, God is free to do that, except when it comes to my life. Okay? Yes, do with his life whatever you want. Leave me alone. But I'm asking the much more fundamental and foundational question here. Is God actually free to do as he wills in the world without ever getting anyone's consent? And is he free as well to withhold the knowledge of himself from some parts of humanity? Is he free to do that or not? Now, of course, we know the answer is he is free to do these things because he is God. But the problem we have here is that our natural tendency, our primal sin suggests that God is not, in fact, free to act as he wills. The intrinsic nature of our flesh, having been born under the curse of Adam, strongly suggests that we are, in fact, the governors of our experience. We are the lords and masters of our lives. That's our natural tendency. In the midst of whatever pain might show up, do we not often assert that such pain is unfair because we did not consent to it? That God did not come and ask for our opinion before he ordained through some secondary means for pain and suffering and difficulty to come into our lives? Is God truly free to send a storm upon this ship? You see, the reality is that it's easy to uphold and defend the sovereignty of God when you're sitting here in this nice, comfortable place. It's a lot more difficult to embrace it when life gets hard, isn't it? It's a lot more difficult to do so when we are in the midst of the storm, whatever it might be. So my friends, brothers and sisters, the time to prepare for the storm is before the storm comes. The time to prepare is now, before the storm arrives. And to get it, firmly established in our hearts and minds that God is God, and that He's free to do as He wills. And we must, even as Job said, cry out, "The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh. Praise be the name of the Lord." But the storm fails to awaken Jonah. See it? Jonah is fast asleep in the belly of the ship even while this great tempest tears the ship apart. Why? Now, I'm one of those light sleepers, you know, all it takes is for a bird to chirp outside and I'm instantly awake. But apparently that's not the case with Jonah. He sleeps through the thing. So the natural question we have to ask is why? How can he sleep through such a thing? Well, the only true answer that you could come up with here, I think, to make this story make any sense, is that Jonah has so convinced himself of the rightness of his choice that he sleeps right through it. His conscience is so seared, as Paul says in 1 Timothy 4:2, that he is quite literally unawakened because he is so convinced of the rightness of his position. He is oblivious to his own sinfulness. He's so convinced that his choice was right that he sees no danger in running from the Lord. We might say he sleeps like a baby. How does a baby sleep? A baby has no cares in the world. All that matters is him. As long as his stomach is full and his diaper is dry, he's fine, right? Sleeps like a baby. With no thought to his own actions. Now, there's a mirror to this story in the New Testament. There's a mirror to this story. Most of you have probably know of this mirror, right? It's found in Luke chapter 8 and verse 22 and following when Jesus gets in a boat with his disciples to sail across the Sea of Galilee. We're not exactly sure which event this is. It's some unknown occasion. But Jesus and his disciples go back across the Sea of Galilee and a great storm arises while they're on the water. And the disciples, again, some of them being experienced seamen, are afraid for their lives. It's a mirror because, in this case, when the disciples awaken Jesus, he also sleeps. The difference is that he rebukes the storm and then he rebukes them for their lack of faith. But in this case, in the mirror, Jesus sleeps soundly for a very different reason. For a very different reason. In his case, his conscience is fully convinced of his obedience to his Father. Jonah is convinced of the rightness of his actions, even though I think he would know that he's going the wrong way, right? But he's so convinced of the rightness of his actions that he sleeps soundly in the bottom of a boat. But Jesus, in Jesus' case, his conscience is fully convinced of his obedience to his Father, and more explicitly knows that there is no way in the world he's going to die in the bottom of a boat. Why? Because his destiny is a cross in Jerusalem. So he can sleep soundly in the bottom of the boat. Jonah is the evil mirror of that story. He sleeps convinced he's doing right because his conscience is seared by his own evil choice. And more specifically, because he despises what God has told him to do. I knew a man some years ago who struggled with physical ailments, one after another after another. He'd get over one and then another would come into his life. And he'd get over that, another one would come into his life. And it seemed like a succession of these sorts of things. And one day, I just said to him, I said, have you ever thought about the possibility that the Lord is trying to get your attention? That maybe the reason why there is a storm every day in your life, one after another, is because he's trying to get your attention. He's trying to go, excuse me, can I have a moment of your time? You see, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 13:5 that we are to always be examining ourselves. Examining ourselves. We must never take for granted that our choices, our decisions, our directions are pure and right. But we must be instead always examining ourselves against the light of what is revealed in the Word of God to assure ourselves that our conscience is truly clean and right with God. We are experts as human beings at convincing ourselves that we're right. You think you got a corner on that? I'm the master of that. I'm convinced that I'm right all the time. Now, I know you do too. It's what we are. I would argue that this is what was placed into us in the garden. That this was hardened into us by what Adam and Eve did. We became little gods thinking that everything we think is right and everybody else is wrong. But those who have been born again by the Spirit of God are instructed by the Scriptures to be constantly examining ourselves. We should be examining our choices. We should be examining what we hold to be true. We must never take for granted that we know all there is to know and that there isn't more that we can understand and learn. We must go to the Scriptures and we must be willing to submit everything we believe to the counsel that's contained in the revelation of God. Jesus could sleep in the bottom of a boat because he knew that everything he was doing, every decision he was making, was absolutely in line with God's word. As the Son of God, how else could he be? Jonah is doing exactly the opposite. Yet he is also sleeping, but for the exact opposite reason. We need to be very careful that we're not asleep at the wheel. It's easy to go there, and I know from what I speak. So now in verse 6 it says, so the captain came and said to him, what do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give thought to us that we may not perish. What do you mean, you sleeper? The New American Standard renders it as, how is it that you are sleeping? The right question. How can you sleep through this? Right? That's what it means. How can you sleep? Do you not know the danger we are all in, right? See above? How do we know? How can you sleep through all of this? See, you will notice here that the captain and the rest, you go down to verse 7, you'll see, all of these men on the boat believe that there is some causal connection, some link between them and the storm. See that? They believe that. In other words, when the captain comes and says, get up and help us, he's not saying, get up and help us throw the cargo overboard. He's saying, get up and appeal to your deity in the hope that you can save us from this because there's a link somehow between us as individuals and this storm, which, of course, we who are reading the story from 30,000 miles, right, we know that to be the case. We understand that there is a causal connection, but these men did too, even in the moment. You might say that at this point, the sailors have done everything humanly possible to save their own lives. So now they must pursue other avenues in order to survive. Okay, I've done everything I can. What else is left? In other words, as I mentioned a minute ago, where do they have to go? They have to go into the religious, right? There's no more human thing I can do. Now I got to go into the religious. So he says, arise, call out to your God. Make some intercession before whatever God you worship. Maybe he will relent of this calamity so that we will not perish. Right? Go talk to your God and see if he has the power to overcome this particular storm. So I'd have you consider this. These polytheistic sailors are unsure which God is responsible for their calamity. Okay? See it? We all have gods that we worship, and we're not really sure which one of them has caused this particular calamity. So we're going to go wake up Jonah and say to Jonah, you pray to your God and we'll pray to our God. They really don't know which one. Now, there's some hint later in this text that they know what Jonah is doing, but you don't get the impression from these verses, without having read that a little later, that these men knew Jonah's God. We'll get to that. I'll explain what I think is the reason when we get there. In other words, I think this is why the captain awakened Jonah. Jonah, we need all hands on deck to make every appeal to whatever gods we can think of. Maybe we can find one that can help us. Of all the gods we know and the pantheons of gods that are represented on this ship, maybe yours can help, so let's all get aboard and let's try to figure this out. See, there's a reality here that you can't really forget, and that is that the vast majority of the world's religions were or are polytheistic. The vast majority of the religions that are surfaced on this planet through the time are polytheistic. The corruption of the image of God, the Imago Dei that has occurred within us by virtue of Adam's fall, has convinced us of a pantheon of gods made in our image. Polytheism, or the belief that there are multiple gods, right? Polytheism is based upon this sense within humanity that we're all just gods, right? Or there's a pantheon of gods above us that are all look like us. We reflexively view the divine, again, this is fallen humanity, we reflexively view the divine as a population of deities similar to ourselves. Even as we are gods, we reflexively think of the divine in that same pluralistic sense, that same polytheistic sense. Because everything we touch, we corrupt. Everything. And we do it by rearranging it according to a view of ourselves. I mean, what other view have we got? Right? The only view we have is us. The only image we have is us. The only example we have is... And so what do? We invent deities. I would suggest to you that this is exactly why the most deeply entrenched form of religion or theology in modern evangelicalism is self-centered. Utterly self-centered. Synergism is self-centered. It's all about us being at the center of the universe because that's what we do. That's what we do. We make it about ourselves. It's about me. You think about the most pervasive religious system in the West, which is secularism. That's a religion, by the way. It has all the hallmarks of a religion. It is one of the most polytheistic forms of religious expression ever invented, where literally every man is a god. The priests of this religion are the influencers of perversion between men, and the sacraments are the rites where personal autonomy is celebrated. Our sacrament is to kill our babies because we have an autonomy. It's a religion. But it's polytheistic. Why? I mean, look, at least we could say one thing about Mormonism. They're being honest. Because they believe that every man is a god. That's what they teach, the foundation of their religious system. At least they're being honest about it. In other words, we might say that modern gods, quote unquote, are fictional constructs devoted to things like happiness. And they take many shapes, many forms. You wonder why it is that these people who have embraced such perversions in our society are so voracious about it. Why they're so demanding that everybody else must embrace it and celebrate it. Why? Because it's at the heart of their religion. It's at the very core of what it means to be that. And it's polytheistic. Because every man is an island unto himself. Every man is a god. And he has made a pantheon of fictional gods in his own mind. A bunch of polytheistic sailors on board a ship trying to figure out whose god is responsible for this. Now, have you noticed the irony here? Have you noticed the irony here? Jonah fled from Israel, right? God came to him while he's in Samaria. He's counseling Jeroboam II, remember? You know, I spent all that history for the last couple of weeks for a reason. Jonah fled away from that. But those people had become polytheistic. What have they done? They've embraced the gods of the Canaanites. They've become polytheistic. Jonah fled from a people who have embraced polytheism to wind up in a ship surrounded by a bunch of polytheistic sailors. See the irony there? You remember, it's a reality that Jonah had overlooked, had forgotten about, was blinded to, is probably a better way to say it, when he fled. In his zeal to pronounce favor upon Jeroboam II and the northern kingdom, he had fled away from that problem right there. A problem that Amos and Hosea had to come just a few years later and preach against. Because he had overlooked it and run away. And that's irony, isn't it? It's what makes Jonah's confession in verse 9 so very, very interesting. Which we'll look at next week, Lord willing. So let me point out something here that should be fairly obvious. It is the captain of the ship that wakes him up. It's not the storm. Remember I said earlier, God sent a storm in order to get Jonah's attention, maybe? No, it took a captain going down into the hold and grabbing Jonah and going, "Wake up!" I would say that the captain was the means that God used to get Jonah awake. The storm wasn't the primary means, but it was helpful. It was ineffective in getting Jonah to see the light, you know, to open his eyes. The captain went down into the hole to awaken him, and Jonah now sees that he and the others are in mortal danger. Jonah must now face his peril. There is nowhere left to run. Well, maybe there is one place. Now, let me take all of that story, just pause here for a moment, and point out something to you. The Christian religion, the biblical form of Christianity, expressed in the true gospel of Christ Jesus, is the most pure form of monotheism. The most pure form of monotheism. The Christian religion certainly teaches there's only one God. There's no pantheon of gods, okay? But it's more than that. It's far, far more than that. When we talk about monotheism, we're not just talking about the fact that there's only one divine person, or one divine being, I should say. But rather, it also teaches not only that there is one Almighty God, but we are not gods. At the very core of the Christian faith is the foundational belief that not only is there only one divine being, there are no other divine beings walking around on planet Earth claiming to be so. There's only one. And we are not him. Or let me put it to you like this. Okay, let me just be a lot more blunt and personal with you. Okay, you are not God. You are not a God. You are not a deity of any kind. You are a created being made in the image of God, but that does not make you divine. That makes you human. There's only one God, and his name is Yahweh. And we know him as the one who revealed himself in the person of Jesus Christ. Satan is not a God. Gabriel is not a God. There are no other gods. There's only one. And we are not him. That's what we mean by the most purest form of monotheism. Christianity comes and says to a polytheistic race of beings, stop thinking of yourself as God. You're not. And this one God, the only one that is God, entered into his own creation in the form of a man. Isn't that delightful? Ironically delicious? God comes along and says, there's no God except me. I'm the only God there is. And then he walks into Bethlehem and Galilee and Judea as a man. Isn't that beautiful? The singular God comes to a polytheistic men in the form of a man to show them the one divine being, that there are no other gods, and we are not gods. That's what he comes to do. He enters into the human race in order to stand before a polytheistic race and say, there is no other divine being. There's only one. And you are not God. I am. And additional to that, he also comes to show us that there's only one way to God. To that one divine being. There's only one divine being, and you're not a part of the pantheon. And here's the one way by which you come to the one true God. Let me suggest to you that you really need to get the word one into your vocabulary, okay? In the old Reformation world, we call it the sola, right? There's only one revelation, it's called the Scriptures. There's only one God, it's called Yahweh. And there's only one representative on the earth who shows us this God, and his name is Jesus Christ. We need to get that idea cemented. Monotheism needs to be at the core of what we understand the Christian religion to be. There is no God except Yahweh, and we are not him. And Jesus Christ came to show us this divine being. The Son of God demonstrates conclusively that no one is God but God himself. That's the message of the gospel. The message of the gospels, plural. The message of Scripture. There's only one God, and the Son of God comes to demonstrate that conclusively. He comes to a world of polytheists and says to them, you know what? You need to be monotheists. And that's the only way to come to the one true God. You are not God. He is. So this supper that we are about to eat together is a testimony by those who know him, that they have, in fact, abandoned all other gods. They've abandoned the God of self-righteousness. They've abandoned the God of religion. They've abandoned the pluralistic self-divinity that is so prevalent in humanity. They come and they say, I believe there is only one God, and he has come to us in the person of Jesus Christ. There's only one way. There's only one way. And when we come to this table, that's what we're confessing. We're confessing there's only one way to God, and it is through the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Period. End of sentence. That's what we're doing. We are putting our eternal destiny in the hands of the one who came to reveal the living God. We're putting ourselves in his hands. The sailors on that boat are desperately trying to find someone amongst the pantheon of gods to help them get through. We know who he is. We have met him. He has come to us. He's revealed himself. He's revealed the one true God to us. And as he does so, we now turn away from all other forms of divinity. And that's what this table is. It is an opportunity for us to say, we're not those pagan sailors. We are fixed on one. His name is Jesus Christ. We know that he was sent by the Father. He is the very essence and fullness of God himself. And he came into the world. The one true God, the only true God, the only God that exists, came into this world and revealed the path to him. For he himself said, I am the way. I'm the truth. I'm the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So that's what we're going to do this morning. We're going to gather before this table and we're going to eat these elements, and they are going to remind us of this fact. They're going to remind us of the fact that we have put our trust in the one God who has come to us in the person and work of the Son. We're going to take these elements and they're going to remind us of that sinless life that he lived, because that's what divinity does. Divinity lives sinlessly. The divine coming to robe himself in flesh lives in this world sinlessly. We're coming to this table and we're saying, the sinlessness that he had is now mine because he's given it to me. Because he's robed me in his righteousness. Just as he robed himself in our flesh, he has now robed us in his righteousness. We eat from this bread. It reminds us of that life he lived as the one true God on earth. And then when we drink of this cup, it reminds us that he shed his blood. He died in order that we might be right with God. That he has opened the way into the presence of the Almighty. He has opened a way for us through his shed blood, by which he made atonement for all of our sin in order that we might come into his presence. You know, I must say, I wrestled this out this week, but I'll say this. This is one of the purest forms of monotheism that exists. It really is. Because when you come to this table, there's only one confession you can make. I am not God, and there's nothing I can do to come into the presence of God. All I can do is lay down my righteousness, my self-righteousness, which was nothing but dirty rags before God, set that down and come to him, the one true God.